For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood.
And we're attending the virtual Boswell Book Festival.
That's right, there was no physical festival this year. It was all online. And coming up in a moment, you can hear Andrew Marr talking about Boswell the man and his own journalistic career.
Janie Godley doing handstands in the dark.
Helen Lewis and Chris Bryant MP will be looking at History Makers, airbrushed from the history books.
And commentator Andrew Cotter will be along with his dogs, Olive and Mabel.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. First on today's show, appearing at the Boswell Book Festival, was journalist Andrew Marr, there to talk about his own journalistic career and his love of James Boswell. He was interviewed by Dr. William Zaks. And please note this interview contains a couple of adult themes.
Andrew Marr, welcome to the Boswell Book Festival. We're grateful to have you here this year to talk about one of your heroes, a man, James Boswell, the father of modern journalism. Tell us, Andrew, what your first appearance in print, is that something you remember with so many words having rolled off the presses?
It kind of depends what you mean by print. I mean, I wrote for school magazines and squibs. I wrote terrible poetry. I have that in common with Boswell, at least. As a young man, I inhaled quite a lot of bad modern poetry and wrote even worse myself. But in terms of journalism, it was when I was a young trainee starting on the Scotsman, very close to where you're sitting then, in those days, just off Flesh Market Close. And I think the first job that you did as a very young trainee, still cutting your teeth in journalism, so far as I can recall, was to record the white fish catches from the ports up and down the East Coast. So it was the Fraserburgh quantity of cod that had come in, the price of halibut, the price of haddock, Fraserburgh, Stonehaven and so forth. Tiny little dreary methodical recording paragraphs, though I would say the last gasp probably of proper old-fashioned fact-based recording journalism as it used to be done. And I was immensely proud when I turned over a few weeks after that to see my first tiny little byline, I think a joint byline on the front page of the Scotsman, and I think it was something about a fire or a council meeting, but I started at the bottom.
Well, many people think of the shipping forecast as a form of poetry, so I imagine the catches of whitefish might ring in a similar way. Although
I can
maybe
assure
not.
You they did not.
Now, what I'd like to show you next is a letter that was written to Boswell by a newspaper proprietor. It was the result, we're going to read this letter in a moment, but it was the result of what was Boswell's first or early publication in book form, a series of rather audacious letters between himself and his great friend Andrew Erskine. It was a great triumph to see his name and his friends and their letters in print. Boswell's father didn't take too kindly to that, though. And the proprietors of the Public Advertiser who had reviewed this book had a very happy inquiry to make for Boswell.
The proprietors of the Public Advertiser are very happy to find that Mr. Boswell is not displeased at the little account of his and his friend's letters inserted in their paper. If Mr. Boswell chooses to have any particular letter inserted, if he will be kind enough to let the printer know by a line, it shall be done. The proprietor hope that if any thin falls on the way of Mr. Boswell or Mr. Erskine, or what would give the proprietors much greater pleasure, if either of these gentlemen should think of communicating anything of their own to a newspaper, that the Public Advertiser may appear as deserving of their favours as any other paper. Or to put it shortly, Boswell, write for us.
Nice to have his writing desirable for the in print. There must have been a moment in your career where the tables turned, and it wasn't the fishing reports, but texts that you chose to write yourself.
Well, I had a sort of Ken Speckle kind of career on the Scotsman as a young journalist. I thought a great deal of myself, and I made some terrible mistakes, as well as, I think, writing some quite good journalism. The worst mistake, I think, of all was when I was a business journalist, and I was on Scotsman's business team, and I had a very sarcastic, even cynical colleague called Arthur MacDonald, who was always looking out of his eye at me with a slight quizzical raise of the eyebrow. And I was sent through to Glasgow because I was told that there was an entrepreneur who had set up a factory, or was about to set up a factory on Skye to manufacture sailing boats with a completely new and environmentally friendly technique involving large quantities of pressed surplus paper and cardboard, which were then formed into the shell of these boats. And I gave him he had a very, very good prospectus, apparently supported by some great Scottish financial institutions. My father was in the investment trust world. And I wrote a great big report about this, you know, boosting this guy. And I got a phone call the next morning at my desk from somebody in the West Highland Free Press. He said, is that Mr. Marr from the Scotsman newspaper, that fine journal? Well, it's so-and-so from the West Highland Free Press. And we noticed your very, very enthusiastic report about Mr. X, who was making this new business. And I just wondered if by any chance you knew that he was facing 14 cases of fraud in Portree Sheriff Court and 27 cases of fraud in Glasgow Sheriff Court, and had indeed absconded and left the country yesterday. Did you know that, Mr. Marr? I went, I didn't know that. He said, and I just wondered, Mr. Marr, whether it ever occurred to you that a man who said he was making paper boats in Skye might be worthy of second or third thoughts, perhaps, Mr. Marr. And of course, I was just drenched with sweat and humiliation and embarrassment at this point. And at that point, my colleague Arthur MacDonald, who I've mentioned, just leaned over from his desk and started very gently to whistle the Skye boat song. So yes, it was a long time before I really broke through. But I then went down to London because I was chasing a girl, basically. And the Scotsman very kindly made me their parliamentary correspondent, who was the lowest of the low, really, in the political reporting world, just literally doing shorthand reports of what people were saying in the Commons. I did that day in, day out, with colleagues from the Glasgow Herald and the Aberdeen P&J and so forth, and the Inverness papers and so forth. And I worked my way up by getting little scoops, by worming stories out of people, late night and in bars and all the rest of it, and playing every kind of journalistic devious trick just to get a slightly better story than my next door colleague. And I jumped through the press, you know, from the Scotsman to the Independent when it very first launched as their political correspondent, then back to the Scotsman as political editor of the Scotsman, then back to the Economist as political editor of the Economist, and so on. And in those days, if you kept getting stories, you could hop from publication to publication. And each time you hopped, you got a bigger salary. And that was really the making of me. It was getting stories in the House of Commons over those years.
Well, Boswell's journalistic career didn't quite have a similar trajectory, but he did, like you, go down to London to chase after, well, maybe not just one special girl, but any number of girls. And the record that we have of this time, the famous Boswell's London Journal, which when it was discovered in the early part of the 20th century, would subsequently become a bestseller. That showed a different side of Boswell to the printed books, indeed, The Life of Johnson, The Hebrides Tour, which also touched upon Skye, although not in a cardboard boat necessarily. But that diary that Boswell kept is one of the most compelling, and I think one of your favorite texts. I remember hearing that your mother gave you a copy.
Impressionable age. I'm sure she had read it, but it was she was a great believer in, if it was good literature, if it was high literature, then I would read it. But I'm going to read, I think, quite a long extract, if people will forgive me. But if there's anybody who doesn't understand why Boswell became such a hit in the 20th century, then they should listen to this, because this is a kind of frankness in writing that I think there's nobody else, except possibly for moments Rousseau, at that period, was contemplating. It's not pornographic, but it's very, very detailed. And this is him finally getting his wicked way with an actress who he had been pursuing across Covent Garden for some time. And it's the 12th of January, so it's cold, the 12th of January, 1763. And this is the journal in full. "When the servant left the room, I embraced her warmly and begged that she would not now delay my felicity. She declined to undress before me and begged I would retire and send her one of the maids. I did so gravely. The night was very dark and very cold. I experienced for some minutes the rigours of the season and called into mind some terrible ideas of hardships that I might make the transition from such dreary thoughts to the most gay and delicious feelings. I then caused to make a bowl of negus, very rich of the fruit, which I caused to be set in the room as a reviving cordial. I came softly into the room and in a sweet delirium slipped into bed and was immediately clasped in her snowy arms and pressed to her milk-white bosom. Good heavens, what a loose did we give to amorous dalliance! The friendly curtain of darkness concealed our blushes. In a moment, I felt myself animated with the strongest powers of love, and for my dearest creature's kindness had a most delicious feast. Proud of my godlike vigour, I soon resumed the noble game. I was in full glow of health. Sobriety had preserved me from effeminacy and weakness, and my bounding blood beat quick and high alarms. A more voluptuous night I never enjoyed. Five times I was fairly lost in supreme rapture. Louisa was madly fond of me. She declared I was a prodigy and asked me if this was not extraordinary for human nature. I said twice as much might be, but this was not, although in my own mind I was somewhat proud of my performance. She said it was what there was no just reason to be proud of, but I told her I could not help it. She said it was just what we had in common with the beasts. I said no, for we had it highly improved by the pleasures of sentiment."
Boswell took great care to preserve his diaries, and his family then, when they dipped into them, were quite shocked what they found. Let's keep on the theme of the journal and look at Boswell's great moment where he persuaded his hero Samuel Johnson to launch off on this rugged trek across Scotland and to produce a book after Johnson's death, just after, called The Journal of the Tour to the Hebrides. Boswell, like you, Andrew, knew the fallibility of memory, and this journal which he kept. Sometimes it was just a brief memorandum, a memoranda of what happened to the day to be written up later on.
You know, the great reporter's thing these days is, when I was growing up as a reporter, is, you know, you have the conversation over the lunch table, you pretend you need to go to the loo, you rush to the loo, and you scribble down in shorthand what has just been said to get it as accurately as possible. And I think Boswell, not the shorthand, but it did a version of that, that he would have his conversation with Johnson or Garrick or whoever was in the room, Sheridan, and these great figures. And he would be thinking all the time, he'd be trying to remember very hard. He would probably be drinking less than he pretended to drink. And then the minute he was home, out would come the pen and the bottle of ink, and he would jot it down as rapidly. And you can see, for instance, his Italian diary, when he's having lots of affairs, he's drinking a bit more. There are endless dashes where he can't quite remember something and he's leaping on to the next thought. So he was trying as hard as he could with the technology of his time, it's a quill pen and a sort of loosely folio of paper, to record accurately the sound and the rhythm of people speaking. And I think that's the great thing about the life of Johnson and the Tour of the Hebrides. You can hear Johnson talk. You know exactly what he sounded like, how he spoke, his periods, his rhythms, his use of words, his sudden aggression, his sudden sort of gentleness and loveliness. It's all there, and he is as vivid in front of you as if, in fact, more vivid than if somebody portrayed him beautifully in a film today. He's absolutely there. That's why I say that Boswell was the great reporter.
Thanks to Andrew Marr and to Dr. William Zaks.
Many of Andrew's books are available commercially in audio and from the RNIB Talking Books Library, as is Boswell's Life of Samuel Johnson, read by Jonathan Oliver. It comes in at a whopping 67 hours and 31 minutes.
That'll keep you busy. You can hear that whole interview for a very limited time at boswellbookfestival.co.uk or by searching for Boswell Book Festival on YouTube. These are just samples, edited down versions of hour-long interviews. And the next needed slightly more edits than the others, discussing some things not suitable for family listening. Here's Sally Magnuson introducing comedian and author Janie Godley.
Welcome everyone to the online Boswell Book Festival. My name is Sally Magnuson and it's my great pleasure to introduce our guest for the evening, the comedian and writer Janie Godley, the woman whose wonderful spoofs of Nicola Sturgeon's Briefings, hilarious but actually giving us the serious public health message very straight at the same time, kept us all going through lockdown. Her riveting memoir, Handstands in the Dark, a memoir of low lives and high times, it's in the best, actually, traditions of Boswellian frankness. It's an account that's engagingly, evocatively written. It's both moving and funny, sometimes both at the same time. And it's an account of growing up in the East End of Glasgow. The horrors in her childhood prompted the Evening Standard to say of the book, it will make Angela's ashes seem like the Famous Five, which does give you a sort of flavour, but the Famous Five were never funny. And this book often is. It doesn't shy away from difficult stuff, not at all, but it is a triumphant celebration of resilience. In her teens, Janie went from the frying pan into the fire by marrying into one of the city's most notorious criminal families with the most terrifying family of in-laws you could ever not want to have. But she wasn't beaten by any of that, and she's gone on to become one of the UK's most popular comedy talents. So here she is now to talk about these books and her life and times. Welcome to you, Janie.
Thank you. I always feel as though you're talking about somebody else when all that is said. I'm like, it's not me. Not you. That's me.
I know what you mean. You say in the introduction to Handstands in the Dark, you say it's a happy book. It's about a girl who grew up viewing the world as something to be taken on, not beaten down by. And that is exactly the feeling you get from reading the book. But I'm wondering, is that hindsight that's given you that perspective? Because there were a lot of unhappy experiences in there.
Mm-hmm. I think that when I was growing up, I was genuinely always knew, and I can't explain why, but I always knew that I was going to be okay. I just knew I was going to be okay. I kind of always had a weird sense of resilience that nobody, nothing will break me, and I will deliberately survive it just to annoy people.
Was that just rooted in you? I mean, is that just the personality of Janie from you know, babyhood, or were there people and influences that made you that?
No, everybody else kinda was a bit beaten, but they still survived. I watched a lot of women who I thought were old women, but they were just women in their 20s and 30s, who were addicted to Valium and Mandrax, and poverty was there, and they just had to live with pawning the shoes and lending money and getting by with secondhand clothes and free dinner tickets and just beaten. And I used to think that, no, this won't be the end. This will not get me. And I don't really know why that I had that. Ashley and I have discussed it at length, and it's like there's some wee strange, creepy ghost inside me that's like, nah, not today, Satan. We'll carry on.
And Ashley's your daughter.
Yes.
But give us a picture of the family you grew up with, your mum and dad, complete opposites, as far as I can gather.
Yeah, there was my mum, Annie, my dad, Jim, and there was Jim and David and me. I'm the youngest. My mammy was, She was a great talker. Annie was a great reader, brilliant reader, loved reading. My dad was born in 1932, and he was the product of a single mother, which you would imagine back then, if we watch the Hollywood movies and the world, would have been the worst thing in the world. But no, his family were, luckily, they weren't God-fearing or Christian. So they, I think the grandfather had just come out of the First World War. And then Julia and Jim was the granny and granda, and they had Martha. Martha had my dad when she was a teenager. My dad died not knowing who his father was. And I said to him, was it terrible in 1932? You were a child, you didn't have a father. Were you called the B word a lot? Were people put... He went, no, my family loved me. My dad was brought up with great love and affection. Nobody thought about giving him away. He knew that Martha was his mother, but he called her his sister. But he always knew it was his mother. So it was like an open secret. So we come for this man who was very much loved and nurtured. And then my mammy, who I suspect came from an abusive background with her father, and her mum died young. So she had a younger brother and sister to look after. So she got married and she had two very young siblings. And crashed together those two personalities. And Annie was not a housekeeper. She used to say, people would say, your house is really dirty. My mad go, yeah, Myra Hindley's curtains are immaculately clean. She's very sarcastic, Annie. And she cared not for gutting the house and going to the steamy like you imagine all those women did. She smoked a lot. She wasn't a big drinker. And she dreamt of being a Hollywood star, but never left Shettleston, and was quite chaotic and full of secrets. All secrets. Don't tell your daddy that you don't have a school blazer. Don't tell your daddy you've got nits. Don't tell your daddy the school sent a letter. So secrets. And I think that was a product of her upbringing. Mm-hmm. But they loved each other. They were never done kissing. I used to try and prise them apart.
But your dad got sort of overwhelmed, didn't he, after a while? And he couldn't really, he retreated into drink. He couldn't really cope.
Well, he it was the time at Beardmore's where you went to the window for your wages. My dad's wages were arrested publicly. Annie was always in debt. We still don't know what she did with the money. I think she had a castle outside Balmoral and was secretly funding that. We don't know what she did with the money because he made a good wage. But I think in the 70s, my dad was an alcoholic. I never knew that because I never saw what we see as an alcoholic is, which is very naive of me and probably a bit defensive. But my dad wasn't rolling about the street, banging his head, drinking a can, lying in the spare ground. He was like all the men in those days. He worked the whole week, put on a suit and went to the local pub, got drunk and then staggered home and then went back to work on Monday and carried on regardless. But in the mid-70s, they separated. I was about early 70s, actually. I was about 11 or 12. I think by the time I'm the youngest, so I think they got exhausted by the time I grew up. They went, oh, we've had enough. But she took it very badly. She took it so, so badly.
You were, I mean, there's some lovely descriptions in there, and there's some great anecdotes. And there's one I'd like you to read, just to give us a wee bit of a flavour of the writing. The one where your mum comes bursting into the pub that you were running. Yeah. At the time.
So by this time, I'm 18 and I'm working in a pub in Shelson, and I've got a boyfriend and my boyfriend's family who I'm trying to impress with my swabba Shelson fare. I hated Mammy coming into the Palaceum, but she would regularly ignore all my protests and march in for a drink with smelly Major 2. This was the second dog with a Major 1. She acquired a second dog called Major, who was cray-cray. And sometimes Biff the cat trotted behind her. We had a cat that was really tufty and a furry, baldy, furry, baldy tail. I suppose I was ashamed of her appearance. Gone was the bright-eyed, dark-haired, smiley woman I remembered from my childhood. Instead, standing there was a grey-haired, sometimes toothless woman. She only wore her false teeth if she happened to find them. She looked like what she was, an old, shabby, scarred, broken housewife, but she still kept her sense of humour. One day she came running into the Palaceum with Major 2 behind her. She pointed to the dog and shouted at me in front of the whole bar, "Your dog has a light bulb stuck in its mouth and I can't get it out." I was about to shout back that it was not my dog when I realised the whole bar had fallen silent and was looking in amazement at Major too. I looked over and sure enough, that idiot shoplifting dog, he also shoplifted, was standing there, lodged tightly in its mouth, a big light bulb. Glaswegians love nothing more than a bizarre problem to solve. I was terrified it would burst in its mouth. Worse still, the stupid animal adored the attention and decided to play a game of chase round the pool table. I felt so embarrassed and wished my mammy would just take Major 2 away, but of course she did nothing of the kind. She took off one of her socks, dropped a snooker ball into it, grabbed Major 2, turned him round, raised her arm and whacked him right in the with her weighted sock. The light bulb shot out like a cannon from the howling dog's jaws and smashed on the toilet door. Almost every man in the room held his crotch in sympathy as the big dog howled in ear-piercing agony. "See," said my mammy triumphantly, "the duck won't bite a light bulb again, will he?" She placed the snooker ball back on the base table, turned on her heels and left Major 2 licking his wounds very publicly.
We're not quite leaving it there, though, as later in the talk, Janie and Sally mentioned something that made our ears prick up here at Read On, the audiobook show. Janie was asked what she did to unwind.
What do you do to turn off a read? Listen to audiobooks. By the way, you can get audiobooks free in the library. You don't have to buy them. Go to your local library, get a PIN number, download your audiobooks. And I gave my book to the listening book people as well, my audiobook. I'm a big audiobook fan.
Yeah, I am as well. I've just started, just this year, I don't know whether it's to do with lockdown or what, started listening to books rather than always reading them.
You get them free in the library, Sally.
I know, I'm on Audible. Didn't know about the library.
Don't care. Get in the library. You now know. You've been told.
For some reason last night, I couldn't sleep a wink, so I thought I'll just listen to an audiobook, and it was so good that I then didn't sleep
yes.
a wink.
Yes.
Anyway.
I've done that. I'll get a wee audiobook to make me sleep the whole night.
Hans Stands in the Dark, written and read by Jeannie Godley, is available commercially now.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from Andrew Cotter about how commentating on his dog's eating made him go viral and publish a book. But first...
A joint talk at this year's festival was by Helen Lewis and Chris Bryant MP, talking about two groups of people making history, but airbrushed from the history books as inconvenient truths. Both were interviewed by author and journalist Rachel Cook. First up, Helen Lewis on Difficult Woman.
I'm going to begin, we've got so much to get through, so I'm going to begin with you, Helen. Can you tell me about the very, very beginnings of this book? I think this book's real engine is a frustration with feminism as it is now, a frustration that I share, but I may be wrong.
Well, I think every generation of feminists is always frustrated with their foremothers, with themselves, with the people slightly younger than them who are doing it wrong. And I think that's probably the condition of every social movement, really. Like there's a kind of idea that if only we could get over all this infighting, then we'd actually get something done. But you have to at some point accept that the infighting is a natural part of any kind of political process. It's how you have, you work out what you're going to do and who's going to do it and who's in charge and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I agree. And it's a book that's still kind of quite relevant, I think. You know, one of those things that happened during the writing of it was that there kept being feminist advances, which was lovely. So, for example, we're going to have no-fault divorce in November. You now have mothers' names on marriage certificates. Just these small little markers of equality have kept cropping up in all the time since I've been writing it. And I kept thinking, oh, God, you know, it's going to be absolutely obsolete and redundant. But it's not really, because all of the themes that underlie it about the idea that you have to, you know, that fundamentally, and I'm sorry, Chris, I'm going to say this, and I say this on my own behalf, you have to be quite weird to get involved in politics and social movements. You have to be somebody who doesn't accept the world, who doesn't want a quiet life, right? And that's the fundamental impulse behind it. And I think it applies to Chris's book too, that sometimes the most interesting, important people in a society are the ones who are at right angles to kind of conventional opinion. And that's the theme that goes through the book for me.
Okay, well, we'll ask Chris about his weirdness or not later, but just two things, really. I mean, you took a thematic approach, I suppose. It's not a particular time or place. You've taken issues, education, sport, divorce, housework even. But you've grouped them together, this title, Difficult Women. I mean, as an old bat myself, obviously, I approve of it. It's it's risky. Just tell me about how you organise the book, because it's very, very challenging to write a book that, you know, has some things going on in the 19th century, some things going on almost now.
Oh, definitely. And it was a way to deal with the idea that basically, I don't know how you know, and every time I read a review of a feminist book, the review is always, well, why didn't you cover X? Where's X? You're like, why haven't you got more of Y? And I thought, well, the problem with that is that unless you're writing about something incredibly narrow, that's always going to be the case. Any subject by definition excludes loads of other things you could have written about. But in feminism, it's almost become a sort of sport to kind of go, oh, you think you've written a good book, have you? Shame if you missed out the, you know, match girl strike of whenever. And I just thought, well, let's embrace that and lean into it. And look, say this is a very personal, peculiar set of choices that I've made. And I've made those choices in full awareness. There are loads of other people I could have written about, loads of other subjects I could have written about. But I think all of these subjects tell a story and add up to something. And so really it runs from the mid 1800s and the fight for custody of children during marriage, Married Women's Property Act, women going to universities, the suffragettes, onto the second wave of the 70s, which was an extraordinarily fertile period for feminism in terms of legal reforms. And then fundamentally, I wanted to say, well, you know, when are the moments that you can point to that something really changed? And that can be very hard. And we have a lot of, I think now, sort of social media campaigning in which a huge amount of sound and fury lets off and everybody feels that they're, you know, that they're laundering their opinions. And then you point to it and you kind of go, okay, but what's changed? What's different? So the fights for me was about saying, well, there is a definitive difference in a society between having the vote and not having the vote. You know, there's a difference between having the legal entitlement to equal pay, whether or not it happens in practice and not. And also, whenever you're fighting for something, you have to make, a choice about priorities. And it's exactly the same with feminism. It is about a language of priorities. By definition, by doing one thing, you are not doing something else. And that was a part of the approach for me about doing a group biography too.
But the difficult women thing, I mean, I you make the point in your introduction that necessarily the kind of women that are able to affect change or even want to affect change are complicated, and that we mustn't expect women necessarily to be likable. Now, this is something I struggle with almost every day. Certainly when I wrote my book, I was almost constantly attacked at literary festivals by women who I could always, they would grumble throughout the event, and then they would finally stand up and say, but this woman did this, she was horrible to her children, or she was horrible to her husband, or she was this, or that, she cheated, or she, and I really struggle with that likability thing, because I just think that all human beings are flawed, and that actually nobody knows what dark things I do in my private life, you know.
Well, now is the opportunity for you to tell
this is something I think your book speaks to very directly, you know, partly because of it does what it says on the tin. These are difficult women, aren't they? They're not likable.
Well, this is exactly, and this is what I mean about it being continually relevant. You know, for example, the statue debate is an interesting one now. There are some statues, you know, the Colston one being a very example, that is a man who was a slave trader, who was famous as a slave trader, who paid for a statue to commemorate his slave trading. Like, that is a cut and dried. I don't really want to see that in a town centre anymore. I don't think that's someone we should celebrate. But then you move on, the line moves to Churchill. And Churchill is a much more typical example, much more like some of the women in my book, who has the CV has got some real high points and it has got some real low points too. And he's got things where he was a man of his time, and he's got things where even by the standards of the time, he was extraordinarily racist. And that's, you know, so you have this bizarre debate where it's Winston Churchill, good or bad? And the answer is both. And the answer for almost every human being alive or every human being who's died is both. And what's interesting about that is, why have we decided to write history as a celebration? And I think this is, you know, feminism and other social movements are very guilty of this. Because there was such a mood during the 70s to reclaim women's history, the default mood seemed to be like, here are the forgotten heroines of yesteryear, and we're going to champion them. We are speaking on their behalf. You know, these are people you should know about, which made a kind of moral claim for them, really, that in many cases isn't justified.
Women's history should not be a shallow hunt for heroines. Too often, I see feminists castigating each other for admiring the Pankhursts, autocrats, Andrea Dworkin, too aggressive, Jane Austen, too middle class. Margaret Atwood, worried about due process in sexual harassment accusations. And Germaine Greer, where do I start? I recently read a piece about how I was problematic for having expressed sympathy for the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. My crime was to say that his confirmation hearing had been turned into a media circus, and even those accused of sexual assault deserve better. The criticism reflects a desperate desire to pretend that thorny issues are actually straightforward. No more flawed humans struggling inside vast, complicated systems. There are good guys and bad guys, and it's easy to tell which is which. This approach is pathetic and childish, and it should be resisted. I want to restore the complexity to feminist pioneers. Their legacies might be contested. They might have made terrible strategic choices. And they might not have lived up to the ideals that they preached. But they mattered. Their difficulty is part of the story.
A clip of Helen Lewis reading from her book, Difficult Women. Also taking part in this talk about history makers airbrushed from the history books was Chris Bryant MP with his book Glamour Boys.
Now, Chris, given how picked over and sort of fetishized the Second World War is, I think this makes your book really extraordinary because it just feels like there is this very, very rich territory that is very unexplored. I think I'm right to say that the beginning of your book starts with a man called Jack McNamara, that's how you got interested in this whole group of people that, who were known as the Glamour Boys and who were pushing against the idea of appeasement. So perhaps you could just tell us about how you first discovered that these men existed.
So I was writing it was meant to be a one-tome History of Parliament. It ended up being a two-tome History of Parliament, which came out a few years ago. And I was doing a chapter about the two world wars. And I came across this paragraph in another book about Jack McNamara. And it said that Jack McNamara was a nearly fascist conservative MP. He was the colonel in charge of the London Irish Rifles. He'd grown up in India. He had his researcher was Guy Burgess, later revealed as the Soviet spy and obviously very openly gay. And he used to go on sex trips to Germany to see lots of young Nazi chaps, along with a married Anglican archdeacon who was his lover. And on at least one occasion, they played table tennis across a dining room table when the role of the net was played by a naked Belgian cyclist who apparently had very fine thighs. Now, that was just intrinsically interesting to me. And as it happens, quite a lot of the supposed facts in there have turned out not to be facts. But I found better facts, more interesting facts. And of course, the big challenge in writing about a gay man from this period is not only that the law forbade homosexual acts, but also people's shame and fear of being revealed, of exposure and being revealed, meant that there was very little documentary evidence. Or so I thought. And originally I wrote a kind of fictional version of this because I just thought there wouldn't be enough facts to find. But in the end, boy, they all sort of started tumbling out of the closets. And in fact, since I wrote the book, there are a couple more that I should have added in.
Right. Now, the book is called The Glamour Boys, and that was in use at the time, but it was a pejorative way of talking about these men. Just tell us a bit about, they're a group of MPs, they're mostly on the right, they're not what we would think of as radicals. They become very associated with Eden, and they are pushing against the government's notion that what the public wants, I think that's important, that what the public wants is appeasement. And they decide largely, I think really because of personal connections with Germany, they decide that this is not acceptable and that they are going to fight for a different line to be taken. You make some pretty grand claims for them, really. I mean, you say that the war might not have been fought at all if it wasn't for them. But I think you should sort of explain who they are and the fact that they're a social group as well as a political group.
Very much so. Basically, it's about a group of men who at the beginning of the 1930s used to like to go to Germany quite a lot because they thought Germany we should have a rapprochement with Germany, that the First World War was over, and Germany was an economic force that we had to do business with. And they enjoyed going to Berlin because it was the best place in the world for gay sex. In fact, it was probably the only place, really, reliably, because the Social Democrat government in Prussia, covering large chunks of Germany, and in particular Berlin, was not implementing paragraph 175 of the German Penal Code. So you could have sex with impunity. And they did. Now, we know of this, of course, from Cabaret, but it's Christopher Isherwood and all that kind of stuff, and W.H. Auden. But there's a group of conservative politicians who go to Berlin quite a lot to have sex. And they get to know some of the early gay Nazis, lots of gay Nazis right at the very top of the organization. All the gay Nazis are killed off in the Night of the Long Knives in 1934. And I never remember anybody telling me in school that the Night of the Long Knives was about bumping off all the homosexuals. But that's what Hitler himself personally told the Reichstag. That's why he was doing it, because of their perversions. So this group, each of them has their own different course. But by the time Eden resigns as foreign secretary, the beginning in 1938, effectively pushed out by Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, and by a dirty tricks campaign run out of by Neville Chamberlain, or on behalf of Neville Chamberlain, by a dodgy man called Sir Joseph Ball. By that moment, there's a group of them who are elected MPs. They're mostly young. They're all on the government benches. They hate fascism. They are distrustful of Hitler and Mussolini, and they want to see Britain ready to fight a war if necessary. Part of Chamberlain's trying to undermine Eden is calling them the glamour boys, because they all dine together. And the word glamour at the time meant like a spell. It was something that was cast over somebody. It was intrinsically feminine, effeminate, not right, morally dubious, meretricious, you know, all of that kind of stuff, a bit of a magpie kind of sense to it, and a witch. And so it was quite a successful little sort of dig at Eden. And Churchill, of course, was part of this group as well. They kept on meeting. They were threatened with deselection. They had their phones were tapped. They were followed. Nasty articles appeared about them, about why are you still a bachelor? And that word bachelor had a real force. Several of them enlist for the war, and then four of them are killed in action.
They were referred to in derogatory code as flamboyant, colourful, unconventional, bohemian, artistic, versatile, or even musical. They were forced to live in the shadows, always looking over their shoulder before they took another man's hand or entered one of the secretive queer bars that managed to survive. Lies and half-truths became a way of life. They invented a secret code of their own, whereby other homosexuals were so, or TBH, to be had. Some tried to be celibate. Others led a double life in a marriage of convenience, which often left pain and anguish in its wake. Many hated themselves as much as they feared detection. The lucky ones could hide behind a wall of privilege in a coterie of like-minded souls, just so long as they chose their company carefully and never made their true nature explicit. Just a few dared the world to condemn them and shared a life, a home, and a bed with another man.
Raj Gattak's reading from Glamour Boys by Chris Bryant MP, available commercially now.
And finally on today's show, let's hear how one commentator lifted our spirits during lockdown with his dogs Olive and Mabel.
Yes, Andrew Cotter was interviewed by fellow sports writer Stuart Weir.
Let's start off. I would imagine that 16 months ago, doing the rounds of bookshops and festivals and interviews, especially when it came to you and your dogs, it wouldn't have been very high on the agenda.
It's been the most extraordinary. I mean, listen, it's been an extraordinary year and a bit for everybody, but even more so, I think, for me. You couldn't have possibly imagined that anything like this was going to happen. But in retrospect, almost, you can see how it happened, because it was such a strange time, March, April last year. that, you know, why not, you know, commentary on dogs going viral. But that certainly wasn't the sort of plan at the outset. It was just a sort of stupid thing to entertain myself and maybe close friends and family. And it just went a bit bigger than that. And I decided, you know, then I did make a conscious decision after maybe three or four of the videos that, okay, well, let's just carry on doing it, because I was enjoying doing it. And more importantly than that, people were enjoying seeing the videos. And then even more importantly than that, I had no work. So it was born out of necessity, not financial necessity, just to sort of entertain myself.
That takes us into pandemic. And you were suddenly, you know, as a broadcaster, you were suddenly pitched into not a state of unemployment, but you were in your way to Cardiff at that point in time.
Well, yeah.
Nothing was happening.
But it was a state of unemployment. I mean, well, as much as a freelancer can be unemployed, they're just sort of always resting between jobs like actors. But it was, I was just getting into the car and the text came to say that the Wales against Scotland the next day in Cardiff was called off. But, and then a couple, it was literally 2 minutes later, an email came in from Augusta saying the Masters had been, they were postponing it. The London Marathon went, the boat race went shortly after that. So I was suddenly looking at everything just falling away. But even then you thought, oh, well, things will maybe be back by June, July at the latest. But then they opened, they took the decision to postpone. And a lot of these, you know, Wimbledon, so it was pretty grim because, you know, you then fall into a bracket that doesn't get any help. You know, I kind of depended on my dogs for moral support. Eventually, with a book, it depended on them for financial assistance as well. So the dogs actually now own me. They and they let me know that.
Yes.
Well, they kind of owned me beforehand.
By its very nature, the kind of viral element is almost what comes from left field. And yeah. nothing can be as left field as an esteemed BBC sports commentator commentating on the activities of his two pitches.
I don't know what the definition of viral is. Now, it used to be officially, there was, if you got more than a million views, yeah, something was said to go viral. But now I think it has to be over 5 million because there are a lot more people on social media or whatever. So, but yeah, so then after the first one, you're thinking, it's like having a sort of hit single. And then someone says, where's the, you know, then you're worrying about how do you find the next one? And then the next one went even bigger. And then you think, well, it can't keep on going like that. But the first four, all had, you know, many millions of views. So, I mean, it was 22 million for the second one just on Twitter. So yeah, but then it sort of tails off a little bit, and not because they're actually the videos, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of them got better and certainly, you know, even a bit more clever, but that viral moment had gone, because that viral moment was of the initial sort of shock and at this content, but also because we were all in that position. We were all just looking at social media going, I don't know what else to do because my job's gone, so let's just have a laugh at some dogs or some cats or pigeons or whatever it might be. When you put dogs into, and that's why the commentary was one thing at the start, but then, you know, you want to move it on and do little sketches with them. And then I think when you start to put them in human situations, and that's why I enjoyed doing the Zoom one, because that was a transition into putting them into human situations. And since then it was online dating, or it was building flat pack furniture, or it was, you know, Halloween or whatever it might be. These two dogs, these characters that you create are in these human situations, and you kind of show up our human conceits and things that we do as a bit ridiculous. Because the dogs are just, they've got their innocent faces and they're just going, this is all a bit baffling to me. So they are that sort of innocent escape, that innocence at the heart of the silliness of our human world, which has been sillier than ever over the last year. People still want commentaries on the dogs, and I won't do any more commentaries on the dogs. And that was a conscious decision, because I won't do commentary on anything silly, because I didn't want to be the joke commentator after a while. And again, people will say, well, Andrew, you know, the horse is out of the stable. But you don't want to be, because you know, like this week I'm doing tennis, and then I'll do Wimbledon, then do the Open Championship and the Olympics. And if you're commentating on the opening ceremony at the Olympics, and all people have heard you doing is joke commentary, you know, I was asked to commentate on rental cars being cleaned, or I was asked to commentate on yogurt for some reason. So, and these still come in, these offers, and I'm not going to do it. Commentary on animals' days are gone. Although I was down filming at Wimbledon the other day, filming a piece with Tim Henman. We were wandering around, and who was there but Andy Murray? And he says hello to Tim. And then he says to me, how are those dogs of yours? And that's it. That's what I'm known as now. I'm the dog guy. But again, that's not a bad thing. I'm quite proud to be the dog guy. It's a connection. The funniest thing is, you know, whether it's Andy Murray or whether it's Hugh Grant or Don French or whoever it might be, they've all sort of said nice things about the dog videos. They're all dog lovers, they're all dog owners, and that's a common connection between everybody in the world, you know, whoever they might be, from the great and the good, you know, all the way down. People love dogs, and that common connection that we're able to have has been one of the best parts.
When the publishers Black and White came along saying, do you fancy doing a book for us? That must have come as a bit of a shock to you.
What I've found out a lot over the last year is, I didn't know about the publishing industry. I didn't, what I knew about books was reading them, but seeing everything suddenly behind the curtain has been fascinating, because it is, to a certain extent, and I suppose that the very frustrating, and I feel guilty about this, but the very frustrating aspect of the publishing industry would be that there are people who will have brilliant books in them, and they've worked and they struggle to get a publishing deal. and if you look at the top 100 books, it's a series of cookbooks, celebrity biographies. What else? Well, that's it. Celebrity cookbooks. I mean, the two combined. So it's of course there are plenty of good, still great novels in there, but it's just full of that kind, because they know that that's what's going to sell. And that's how the book deal came about for me, because after the second video, Black and White Publishing took a bit of a punt and said, would you fancy writing a book about this whole experience and about dogs and about Olive and Mabel? And it was mostly supposed to be about Olive and Mabel and me in the mountains initially, mm-hmm. until it got slightly tweaked. But the point is that they took the chance slightly earlier because they felt this might take off, and they took a bit of a gamble, and it has been reasonably successful. The next part of it for me that was so important was that I didn't want it to be just a book that rode off the back of the success of the videos. You could easily have made it a book that sold X amount because people bought it because they'd seen the videos, but actually the book was a series of pictures and some, large font, 20,000 words of gibberish. Whereas in the end, it was about 70,000 words of gibberish. So it was, but I wanted it to be a book that could stand alone, whether you'd seen the videos or not, it could stand alone as a sort of love letter to these two dogs from me, but a love letter from all owners to all dogs, and sort of lightly humorous along the way. And that's been the most positive feedback. I mean, people saying, I wasn't sure how the humour of the videos would possibly translate to the book, but I really enjoyed it.
You as I know a great many commentators, and a lot of them were already practicing and mastering their art aged 8 and 9. Mm. Were you such a kid?
No, I didn't know what I wanted to do until, I still don't know what I want to do, to be honest, but I certainly didn't know at school. I didn't know at university. I didn't know for a year or so after university when I was working as a waiter. I loved playing sport. I didn't want to really talk about it. I didn't, and I'd still rather play sport than watch sport or talk about it. But unfortunately, with increasing decrepitude, you can't do quite as much as you used to. So, but no, I wasn't one of those. I'm always a wee bit wary of people who say from a very young age, this is what I want to do. I'm gonna, it's a bit odd. Don't be scared of not knowing what you want to do. We had careers and counsellors coming around at, when we were 14 or so, saying, would you like to be an accountant? I said, I don't know, I have no idea. So I fell into it, as a lot of people fall into their jobs, because I wanted to use language. I did love sport, still do love sport, sorry, past tense. I loved sport at the time and thought, well, I wonder if I could do something with that. I actually applied for a news job with a local radio station, with Scott FM. They said, that job's gone, but I see you've got sport on your CV, so would you like to work in the sports department? And that was that. And, and it's kind of, you fall into a job and you find you can do it and you find you enjoy it. And it just sort of happens that way. It's a series of happy accidents and timing, and suddenly, you're 25 years down the line.
What was your excitement level like? And in terms of, career-wise, did you think, I have now made it, when you got to commentate on Martina Navratilova against Piers Morgan?
Yeah, there were a couple of moments off the back of Olive and Mabel that I thought I've whatever the opposite of peaked is, I've bottomed out. I'm bouncing along the bottom, and I'm commentating on, yeah, because, well, it's interesting, publicity of a book is I found out the biggest thing. You could have, I'm not saying this book is, but I'm just saying you could have the greatest book in the history of the written word, and if you don't get people to know about it, if you don't get the interviews, then it doesn't matter. It's all about the interviews. So when we were trying to get interviews to plug the book, and then you try and get on, and they say, oh yeah, well, we had you on in June when you did the dog stuff. I know, but I didn't have a book out then, so could I come on again? But then you get onto them, but they obviously want you then to do something for them. So on Good Morning Britain, as it was, they said, we will have you on, but could you commentate on Piers Morgan playing table tennis against Martina Navratilova? That's all fine. Actually, when I went on Lorraine Kelly's programme as well and had to commentate on her dog, Angus. But that was actually I quite enjoyed that as well. And she may well be the loveliest person in all of broadcasting.
Dogs love to be trained, or at least to play a game that challenges whatever brain cells they might possess. They are very willing to learn, but the trouble is that they don't get bored with the process quite as quickly as we might. We had also been reliably informed that dogs, or certainly Labradors, are desperate to please their owners, and that this can be used very effectively in training. But with my experience of labs now, I believe there is a clear hierarchy in their heads of what is most important. 1. Food. 2. Food. 3. Food. 4. Also food. 5. Human approval. And I'm not even sure that human approval should be as high as number 5.
A clip of Andrew Cotter reading from his book, Olive, Mabel and Me, which is out now in print and audio. Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week.
As we said during the show, these are just small samples from the full talks, which are available for a very limited time at boswellbookfestival.co.uk or by searching for Boswell Book Festival on YouTube.
And why not subscribe to the Read On podcast? You'll find us by searching your usual provider for Read On, the audiobook show.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Red is at RedSale, REDSZELL, and I'm at talking_books.
Thanks to everyone at the Boswell Book Festival.
And hopefully we'll both be there in person next year.
Fingers crossed. Well, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.